Walking the Talk.
This is 702.
702.
On the Hanging Out feature from now to 11 o'clock. And with that, we welcome Mark Haywood. Mark Hay, welcome. I hope you're well.
Good morning, Thabo. Lovely to be with you and the listeners, and thank you for having me today.
No, thank you for coming through. And this time around, we are not going to be having heated exchanges about one policy or the other, but we just want to get to know you a little bit better, because your contribution, Mark, cannot be ignored in South Africa and obviously beyond. We can't ignore your contribution. You are a very steadfast activist, but it didn't start in South Africa, did it?
No, it didn't. It in fact started in a number of countries. I went to school in England and university in England as well, at a time that was very important in England's politics, and I became involved in struggles in England supporting things like the mine workers who were on strike for a year in the 1980s. And, you know, just joining organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch and others as a youngster. So I guess the kind of foundations for my beliefs and my convictions and my activism really started as a young child. But I have to say, Thabo, that although it didn't start in South Africa, it was very, very strongly influenced by the struggle against apartheid, by my upbringing and the fact that I grew up in a number of different African countries. In fact, I was born in Nigeria.
Really?
Very interested to know, and grew up in Nigeria and Ghana in particular.
I suppose it started at home. Did your parents have anything to do with this? Were they also social justice activists?
No, funnily enough, they're not. My mum is a passionate believer in equality and has been a teacher all of her life, a gym teacher. My father, in fact, he died nearly 10 years ago, but was a banker for Barclays Bank. And he and I had diametrically opposed views on justice and politics and so on. But somehow out of that mix, I was able to hold and develop my own views.
And I mean, when you're developing your own views, Mark, I suppose your society also has something to do with it. Those would be some of the influential factors at school and in your surroundings, because if at home it was not that strong. But what really pushed you? Do you even remember the very first issue that you raised, however frivolous it might have been in retrospect? But do you remember one of the very first ones where you took an issue on vehemently?
Well, as I mentioned, you know, growing up in independent, fairly newly independent African countries in Nigeria and Ghana, in 1977, the family arrived and my father moved to work in Gaborone in Botswana. Mm. And suddenly, as a 13-year-old boy, South Africa was just on the border. And obviously, South Africa looked and behaved very, very differently because of apartheid, because of institutionalized racism, legalized racism, to what I had grown up with. And it shocked me, and it shocked my senses. And 1977, of course, was the year of the murder of Steve Biko, which I read about and I felt deeply. And I think it was that experience, really. You know, it wasn't my intention as a 13 or 14-year-old boy to become an activist for all of my life. I think it was just things that touched me and moved my conscience. And then a kind of series of almost accidents that led me into working for human rights throughout all of my life. As a youngster, I wasn't planning to be a human rights and social justice activist. I loved literature. I studied English language and literature at Oxford University. And when I came back to South Africa in 1989, I studied African literature. I wanted to be a writer or a poet. But things took me in a different direction.
Yeah, and I suppose you might have fed that bit of hunger of writing and going through some bit of literature in your tenure as the editor at your erstwhile job at Daily Maverick.
Yeah, I've always loved writing. I love great literature. the great literatures of the world. And I've always found that the pen is a very powerful way of conveying truth, of investigation, of argument. So I've written a lot, you know. I've written a couple of books. I've written a book of poetry. And I spent 5 years until December of last year as the founding editor of Maverick Citizen, which was a section of the Daily Maverick reporting on human rights and activism and social justice. So that was a great experience. And I still, you know, writing is powerful. And I still feel very committed to doing it whenever I can.
Some authors that you revere, I'm sure there are many, but one or two.
Well, my PhD in South Africa was on the South African writer Archibald Campbell Jordan, who you probably know, Paolo Jordan's dad.
Great academic.
Wonderful novel, Ngombo Yeminyanya, which he himself translated into English in about 1940. But then, of course, I love, you know, the other greats of world literature, George Orwell, Shakespeare, Keats. You know, I'm both a classical reader of literature, but also a reader of modern literature. And I try to keep up to date with modern writing. I've read this year's Booker Prize Prophet Song by Paul Lynch about Ireland and authoritarianism. So, you know, literature constantly throws up, reveals, shows new ways of looking at things and writing, and educates and informs. So I'm very passionate in my belief in reading and education and the power of reading and education to help transform society.
Mark, how would you, in your own words and experience, I suppose, define an activist? Because it's a very loose term. Everyone else sees themselves as that. They might just be someone sitting at home right now on Twitter, and they may be having a heated exchange about one social justice issue or the other. But what's an activist according to you?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and I'm trying to write a book even about activism. But it's a simple question in one sense, Thabo, in the sense that an activist is somebody who steps out of their comfort zones, who works not just in self-interest, but in the public interest, and who takes action and pursues actions for wider societal change and for betterment. But of course, you can have a whole spectrum of activists, can't you? You can have activists who are activists for Donald Trump and make America great again, and you know, for racism and xenophobia. I'm an activist who's a human rights activist, a social justice activist. So there's activism, but then there are the beliefs and the convictions that underpin that activism, and they lead you to do, I think, quite different things. I've always just been driven by a belief in equality, by a belief that everybody has dignity, that everybody should have equal opportunity, and that our society is capable of being run in a way that allows everybody that equality. That's what I struggle with most, is, you know, the inequality where some people have fabulous opportunities and riches, and some people don't even have a plate of food to eat.
There's a very derogatory phrase that comes to mind about peacetime revolutionaries, and you can never be that. Your credentials speak for themselves. And I'm just wondering about how difficult it must have been during the unpopular times. It was not always popular, and you have gone through some interesting times during that HIV/AIDS debacle, where you were pushing very hard for those infected and affected. I'd like you to say a little bit about that, because, I mean, beyond the headlines, beyond what we see on TV, there must have been moments where you were despondent, where you were losing the fight. I mean, generally, you were fighting the state and fighting against one of the most powerful people in the country, who took a very strong stance. And did you feel that you were going against the tide?
Yes, we did. And to answer your question, you know, requires that I step back just a little bit. You know, one of my friends and comrades throughout life is Zaki Ahmad.
Mm, mm.
And, you know, I got to know Zaki in the 1980s during the anti-apartheid struggle. And it was through Zaki that I came to understand the issues around HIV and discrimination against people who live with HIV and the human rights violations. And, you know, I had no idea about what was going on when I started working on AIDS in 1994 with Edwin Cameron and people at the AIDS Law Project. So we set up the Treatment Action Campaign in December 1998. That's 25 years ago, just over 25 years ago. You know, because we wanted to fight for the lives of people living with HIV. We wanted to make medicines, antiretroviral medicines, affordable to people. We wanted to make it possible for people to live with dignity and to live with equality. And when we set up the TAC, you know, we actually thought that our biggest fight was going to be against the pharmaceutical companies because they were excessive pricing of the medicines. And then we found that we were fighting our own government, in particular, President Thabo Mbeki, who had embraced what we call AIDS denialism. He was saying there's no such thing as HIV. HIV doesn't cause AIDS. Antiretroviral treatments are poison. And so it became, you know, it wasn't our intention, but it became a very bitter fight against the government and against the government, which you'll remember was, you know, our democratic government at that point was only 6 or 7 years old. So it's not like today where everybody's criticizing the government, where everybody's disappointed. There was still a lot of hope, a lot of belief, a lot of trust. So it did feel as if we were going against the stream, but we had to do what we had to do because our friends and comrades were dying of AIDS, and they were dying of AIDS despite the fact that there were medicines that were available that could prolong life. So we took our confidence and our conviction from the Constitution. And I think that's a lesson for today as well. I mean, although many of us had grown up in the ANC, many of us were part of the liberation struggle, you know, we had to say, well, the liberation struggle was for dignity and equality, and that's what we continue to struggle for. It's not about a particular party or a particular president. It's about the peoples whose lives are meant to be bettered by democracy. So that's a long way of answering your question and saying that, you know, the work with the TAC was incredibly inspiring. We built such a powerful, important movement, but it was also painful because it is difficult to be in opposition. And it was painful because we lost many loved ones.
And after the break, I'd like you to reflect on that particular period to suggest that was it the most challenging period in your activism life? And I know I'm just asking you to choose your favorite kids here because I know every project is very important and there have been many others. But at that particular point, I'm wondering if it was the most prolific one as far as challenges are concerned. But we'll chat about that after the break. My guest, Mark Haywood, 21 minutes after 10 o'clock.
This is 702.
702.
24 after 10 o'clock, you're on 702 and my guest is none other than the revered activist, social justice activist. He wears many hats, of course, as a lecturer, as an activist. He's done quite a lot in South Africa. There's no way you would have missed his contribution in the country on the social justice field. And his name is Mark Haywood. He's on our Hanging Out feature today. If you'd like to chat to Mark, ask him a question, especially about those times, if you remember them quite well, feel free to give us a call on 011-883-0702. Alternatively, send a text message or a voice note to 072-702-1702. Mark, I was just saying prior to the break that we had that it must be very difficult because all causes that you take up are very important. I remember the pit latrines issues and many others. And it's quite unfair to ask you which one really, really stood out and which one was most challenging, I suppose, would be the best way of trying to euphemize my question. Was it far harder at the time to fight, given the explanation that you've just asserted now about the time, the hope, and I suppose more difficult to mobilize society against a very newly established democratic government, where some people might have said, give us a chance, but also, I mean, against the head of state. Against the head of state, that must be very difficult. Was it extremely challenging, or were there others which were more challenging than that particular cause?
Well, it was very challenging, but you know what helps you to overcome the challenge, and it's something that's kept me going throughout all my life as an activist, is just the wonderful people that you work with, the energy, the ideas, the sacrifice, the commitment of ordinary South Africans. And, you know, the Treatment Action Campaign was built in difficult circumstances, because you'll remember that, you know, very few people were willing to be open about living with HIV. So it wasn't just fighting a government. It was mobilizing a movement of people who were discriminated against, stigmatized, people who were ill. But despite all of that, you know, we built it in a way where at the height of the Treatment Action Campaign, we had about 50,000 volunteers, and we were able to influence and sway society in support of access to treatment and a national treatment plan. And what I can say, Thabo, is looking back on that, is it teaches me a couple of things. One is that people in our country have power. If they use that power, they have the power of the Constitution, they have the power of the vision of dignity and equality and liberation. And when we use that power, we can bring change. So as you and I have this conversation today, you know, there are nearly 6 million people living with HIV accessing antiretroviral treatment on a daily basis through the state because of that struggle, because of that campaign. So that is something that gives you energy. But, you know, the activism is always full of highs and lows.
Yeah.
It takes you into the dark recesses of society. It shows you at times cruelty and callousness by government, by businesses, by people against each other. And at other times, it shows you the best of people, people's willingness to sacrifice, to show solidarity. So, you know, my career, for want of a better word, has involved HIV, but it's also involved the Life Esidimeni disaster and what was done to the people who were staying at Life Esidimeni. It's involved working with the Kamape family, the parents of little Michael Kamape who drowned in a pit toilet. You know, those are terribly painful and sad things to internalize when you're working as an activist, because you have to internalize it. You know, if you're working on a legal case, if you're working on planning a campaign, you have to feel those things. And it's painful to feel and be close to such pain. But the pain is always mitigated by the power of the people that you work with. And one thing about activism is it's not a one man or one woman band. It is a collective effort. And through that collective effort, we bring about change.
I mean, that's extremely powerful, that it depends on a network of resources, individuals, expertise to advance a cause. And Mark, before we go to the Eyewitness News headlines shortly, I just wanted to find out from you, did you ever get an opportunity to kiss and make up with the former president? Was there an opportunity to shake hands and say, let's agree to disagree, or that chance never came?
Look, Thabo, that's a difficult question. There's never been a kissing and making up between President Thabo Mbeki and the Treatment Action Campaign.
Yeah.
And it's not because we are not, because we're unforgiving.
Yeah.
It's because President Thabo Mbeki to this day has not owned up to the harm that he caused through AIDS denialism and delaying access to treatment for people living with HIV. You know, it's estimated that 336,000 people at least died unnecessarily because of the delay in providing access to treatment. And that is still something that our society has to grapple with and get to terms with. So I'm a person who doesn't like holding grudges, doesn't like living with conflicts with anybody. But that is a, you know, a, a wound in our society, not a wound between President Mbeki and the Treatment Action Campaign. It's a wound between that government and the millions of people who lost loved ones as a result of that terrible approach that was adopted.
Certainly, and I've been talking so much, I forgot even to play some of your favorite tunes that you've sent through to us, and we'll do that after Eyewitness News headlines. It's exactly 10:30.
Join us.
Let's walk the talk.
This is 7:02.
It's 7:02, Mark Haywood, my guest. My name is Thabo Shwele Mashau. I'm in for Clement. We're together till 12. 072-702-1702. And my guest, as I said, is Mark Haywood, an activist par excellence. Mark, what brings you closer to Peter Tosh? I wouldn't have imagined that you would listen to Peter Tosh at all. Is that the kind of sound that influenced you?
Yes, very much so. In fact, you asked me about some of my memories. I can remember very vividly the day that Bob Marley died in 1981, and I've always been inspired by the life, music, and political vision of Bob Marley. And of course, an offshoot of Bob Marley is Peter Tosh. Sure. And, you know, Peter Tosh was sometimes a little bit more outspoken and direct than Bob Marley in some of his lyrics. In fact, the two of them had a bit of a fight. I love reggae music, particularly the reggae music that came from Jamaica in the 1960s, late 60s, in throughout the 70s.
Well, without any further ado, this is one of the songs that you chose, and this is Peter Tosh. In case you are thinking that you are listening to Jamaica FM, no, it's still 7:02. That's Peter Tosh, Equal Rights, and one of their favorite songs of Mark Haywood, our guest here on Hanging Out. Your text messages, I've been receiving them right here on 072-702-1702. This one says, Mark, a true South African hero, thank you for your commitment to an equal society. It must have broken your heart to hear about that little crash child drowning in a pit toilet yesterday. It is so disgusting that this can still happen. When will our country get this right? It seems that there is just no will. And this is from Felicity. Question for Mark from your text messages. This one says, question for Mark. The solution to pit latrines or poor sanitation lies with engineering. Must we, as activists, call for a change of engineering general office to hold all infrastructure to account and issue binding recommendations? We'll come back to that. We'll ask Mark to respond to that. But let me just cover one or two of your text messages as well. This one says, morning, Thabo and Mark. I must say that because of people like Mark who advocated and fought, even when it was difficult to get ARVs, and many others are alive and living healthy. I was infected 16 years and been on ARVs since. And I know people who were born with HIV/AIDS and they are still living happy, healthy life. Thank you, Mark, and all those who fought for our lives. I also advocate for those infected to take the treatment. My viral load has been undetectable for over 12 years now due to the treatment I'm taking, and I'm living a healthy, happy life. And Tracy here says, just saying hello to Mark. Ask him if he's still doing road running races in his busy schedule. Thanks for that, Tracy. Mark, do you still run around? Do you still have time?
I'm growing older these days, so I run park runs. I'm getting close to my 100th park run. So, yes, I still do races, but long-distance races are a thing of the past, unfortunately. I did, in all of those years, somehow I found the time to run the Comrades Marathon 20 times. I don't know how I did it, but it was one of the things that I used to keep me sane and focused on the struggles that we were involved in. But yes, I'll always run because I love it. It's It's a way to think and feel and be part of communities.
How I wish I had your will. I plan to run all the time, but it just never happens. Sleep takes over for some reason. I hope I'll gather some courage soon. But Mark, there was a very interesting question coming from one of our listeners, and I'd like you to speak to it. And just to refresh your memory, this question was saying the solution for pit latrines, poor sanitation lies with engineering. Must we as activists call for a Chapter 9 institution, engineer general office to hold all infrastructure to account and issue binding recommendations?
I think that's a great question. And, I agree with the listener that we have to understand and work with engineers much more closely as activists, because so many of the social problems that we face in South Africa are linked to the state of our infrastructure and the fact that we have neglected our infrastructure because we have neglected the role of engineers in advancing socioeconomic rights. You know, if you take pit toilets, the problem with pit toilets was never that there was not toilets that could be put in schools that were safe, that were clean, that were dignified, and that were affordable. The problem simply was that provincial governments in provinces like Limpopo and the Eastern Cape simply did not care about poor children and about the quality of sanitation in those schools. So they made lots of excuses. And as you mentioned, Thabo, I think, you know, we still have children dying in pits toilets, and it's a national shame and a horror that that is the case. I don't think we need a Chapter 9 institution, but I do think we need to raise awareness around these issues. You know, everybody has been preoccupied with Eskom, understandably, for the last few years because of load shedding. But I can tell you that an even bigger crisis is coming around access to water, which is a big engineering question. You know, it's estimated that to bring our water infrastructure up to scratch, we need to spend R1 trillion over the next 10 years. So infrastructure for water, to make sure that people can drink, to make sure that people can wash, to make sure that we can grow food, is another critical question. And that's the nature of activism. You know, you constantly having to survey the environment and make the connection between people's fundamental rights in our constitution and the skills and discipline and resources that are needed to make those rights possible.
This one comes from JJ Taba, and he says, Mark is a fantastic South African, an example of an active citizen we should all emulate to sort out societal changes. It's 14 minutes to 11 o'clock.
For more about 702,
go to primemediaplus.com.
13 minutes to 11 o'clock, we continue our discussion with my guest on hanging out with Mark Haywood. Mark, I mean, beyond the activism, then you went over to do what you loved, of course, writing. And I'm just thinking out loud, especially about the Maverick Citizen there, about the kind of pieces that you had to edit and the kind of submissions that you received. How do South Africans respond, especially to a digital platform where these issues are raised? Do we still need to somehow permeate various other sectors of society digitally to have a sizable impact? Or as it is right now, it is reaching and hitting the mark?
We still need to permeate a sizable section of society, and we still need to hear the voices and the stories and the concerns and the solutions of a sizable section of society. You know, what concerns me is that we're a democracy of 60 something million people, but we hear very few voices. So the opportunity of something like a digital media platform like the Maverick Citizen, part of the Daily Maverick, for me was an opportunity to bring the stories that are not heard of ordinary people, you know, to bring activism, because activism is what makes the world go round. It is what changes society. It's what draws attention of governments to things like pit toilets to diseases like HIV, to the crisis in education. So I still think that there's a problem with the way we tell the news, because we tend to tell the news of big politicians and elites and rich people, and we ignore the stories and the lives and the contributions of the vast majority of people in this country. So if I could be doing two things at the same time, I would still be that as well.
Yeah, yeah. Then you took a leap to politics. Don't you think that that's going to somehow polarize your fan base, so to put it? And some people say, oh my goodness me, now he's gone to politics. We can't express our love to Mark like we used to. What pushed you to cross that line and to say, I want to be directly involved and not be on the other side?
Well, you know, Thabo, everything that we do in life is political. And in our country, you know, again, because we're a participatory democracy, as citizens, we're meant to engage in politics, in policy, in lawmaking all of the time. You know, I've worked for 30 years in civil society organizations like the Treatment Action Campaign, Section 27, Corruption Watch, Save South Africa. And what I've found is that, you know, very often people on civil society do fabulous work, come up with great solutions, but we're on the outside of government, and government doesn't listen sufficiently to what people are putting forward. So it's not that I've gone into politics. It's more that I'm trying to take social justice, take human rights, take the ideas that civil society generates into the heart of government, because the heart of government, as we will discover again in just over a month's time, is the people we elect to represent our interests. So I don't think people should be put off by it. It's not in any way a change of approach by me or a change in beliefs by me. It's just a question of, where do I think we need to be to build the society that our constitution dreams of, which is a free, equal, dignified society for all people in this country.
Yeah, and the line that I'm talking about that you crossed, you started off first with Change Starts Now of Roger Jardin. Was it a big letdown when they didn't want to go ahead with contesting the elections? Is it what made you then skip over to Rise Mzansi?
No, I wouldn't say it was a letdown. You know, life and activism involves great leaps forward and sometimes steps backwards, or it involves victories and sometimes things don't go as you planned. I think the idea of Change Starts Now was a visionary and a great idea. We need new politics. We need new leaders in our country. We need people who've not been tainted by corruption and mismanagement. But at the end of the day, Thabo, starting Change Starts Now in December of 2023 with the election in May was just too high a mountain to climb.
Yeah,
I'm working with Rise Mzansi because I look at Rise Mzansi and I see a party that has been built from nothing in just over a year, that's made up of young people, which has an energy, which believes in human rights, which is standing for accountability and transparency. And we need young people to come into politics. And we need young people who lead with ideas about human rights, social justice. You're asking difficult questions at the end of a long conversation because we could go on for another hour.
Yeah.
But I've come to the view that almost all of the existing political parties have failed our country and failed our country badly. And they've created the inequality and the social crises that we have been discussing, and that they cannot be trusted, that we need a new political party. But actually, Thabo, we're going to have to change so much in the next decade, because we've pushed our world to its limits. We're going to, with the crisis of climate change coming, with what is happening with wars in the world, we're going to have to try to reconsolidate South Africa and reconsolidate politics around serving the country, around serving the people, around serving the vision of the constitution. So it's all part of a broad project try to put South Africa back on a path to real freedom.
Sure. Let me just take a quick call. 011-883-0702. Caroline, you're calling from the West Rand. Good morning to you. Caroline? Oh, I'm going to ask you just to move around. Try to move around. We can't hear you very clearly, so that we can hear everything you have to say.
All right. So I'm so very, very, very grateful for you because you did help my son. When my son was dying, you and 702 people, you helped. I'm so grateful. And I don't want to see you close or anybody. And I just so grateful for all of you people. Oh, I'm so grateful.
Oh, Caroline, did Mark assist one way or the other with your son?
Yes, yes, he did. He did call Bongani. Bongani helped 702, all people that were there. They helped so much for Andrew to go to the hospital of Pretoria because he was dying.
How's Andrew now?
Andrew is getting better, but he's still depression. You know, he's still in depression. He needs counseling, but I don't know.
Do you want to say hi to Mark?
Yes.
Mark?
Hello, Caroline. It's lovely to hear from you. And I was very happy to be able to help and to write about what had happened and to assist with Bongani and others to make sure that he got the medical treatment. And again, you know, the story, Caroline, you're telling is a story of lots of people who came to Andrew's assistance. And it proves my point that there's a lot of good in our society and we need to bring the good together to help each other rather than just living in a way that is selfish against each other.
We were so worried last we hear you close. I almost wanted to faint when I hear you close. I thought maybe you were done and dusted, gone now. I say, oh my goodness, how can we help?
He's still around. Caroline, thank you so much for the call. Mark, is that the reward that you get? And is that what makes you sleep peacefully at night? Such calls.
You know, Thabo, I don't know if I sleep peacefully at night because I'm very troubled by the state of our society and the state of our world. Yeah. And it's hard to sleep at the moment, really. It hurts a lot what is being done to the Palestinian people, what we are doing to our own people, the hunger in this country. But it is, you know, activism has its rewards, and the rewards is being able to make a difference to other people's lives and the joy and opportunity and hope that you can bring. And as we said, you know, we've been talking about HIV and the Treatment Action Campaign, and that movement saved 5 million lives, not me, a whole movement. And what I often say to people is that if we did that with HIV, we can do it with the other social issues. We can end hunger. We can end violence against women. We can improve our education systems. There's so much that we can do if we work effectively together as people.
Certainly. And one of the last text messages to come through says, Mark Haywood, may you see heaven. God bless you. Whatever your religion is, Mark, I'm sure that you'll take it in good stride. But thanks for making time. Thanks for speaking to us. It means the world to us, Mark. We often celebrate people who are superstars singing on stages and acting, and they're doing a beautiful job, I'm sure. But it's also a great privilege to speak to someone like you who touches lives every day. And chances are you don't even get to see the impact of the work that you do. So thank you very much for speaking to us and for all that you do.
Thank you very much, Thabo, and it's been a privilege to spend this time with you and to interact with the listeners. And my only message is we've got to fix this world and we've got to ensure equal rights and justice, as Peter Tosh said so many years ago.
Activist par excellence, Mark Haywood.